Okay. So, yeah, for those of you who don't know, since I have a few, shall we say, colleagues from the pool here and others, you know, it's a book about swimming. And I wrote it 4 years ago. It took me a few years to find a publisher, but I've been swimming for 30 years roughly. And however, I grew up across the street from the ocean and never was interested then. Mm-hmm. And so my parents, my parents would make me take swimming lessons every year. And finally it paid off, much later. But instead I would either play baseball or I'd stay inside and watch baseball on TV or, et cetera. But after all these years, as a writer, it's like, well, for me, I swim a mile, it's 40 minutes for me, and where are your thoughts going? For me, it was always interesting to think of, okay, what exactly does your mind do in all that time? So this is a little bit of some of it tracing that, some of it it's reflecting on different places I've swum and the differences. And so I first started doing, I was living in Paris in the 80s, and I started there at Paris Pools. And at that time, I don't think the swimming laps was as common. And I remember the first times I went, and where it was an effort for me to do one lap, and then the next day maybe do two laps, etc. And seeing a couple of people who could just come and go, and I was amazed. However, everything around them in the Paris Pools was chaos. People would jump in and, so I realized, particularly doing that there at that time, really had to develop a sort of peripheral vision because, anything could come at you. But anyway, I'm not going to read from those parts necessarily, but anyway, you'll see. So most of them, the longest pieces are about 5 pages, and many of them are two or one page, so mostly I'll be reading the shorter ones. So from early on in that intermittent life, like a dream world that we return to with anticipation and abandon, as if it were but a sub-rhythm within our waking life, or what we think of as our waking life, in which we leave some kind of wake behind us, though seldom quite what we imagine. Once I was able to get beyond the exclusive concentration on my own efforts, one of my favorite amusements came to be watching the bodies of my fellow swimmers. Unlike fish, I think, we don't actively communicate underwater, but we do see and look at others around us. I do, at least. How the bodies are shaped, thin or round, taut or lumpy, and how those bodies move. The cut and color of the bathing suit also add to the spectacle and provoke idle wondering about just why the person chose that shiny or drab pattern. Maybe it's time to buy a new suit. This one's not so flattering. My thoughts do not arrive at many conclusions about the personality or habits of other swimmers, at least not based on their suits or the shapes of their bodies. Rather, such sights draw my attention along for a little while before it wanders off. But there are times when a particularly shapely body, usually female but not always, sustains my curiosity enough to imagine what must the face look like floating along there on the surface of the water. Or more likely to question, for my mind does not go so far as to pull up an image of a face. I'm speaking of swimmers I haven't seen before or noticed in that way, but it is always an elusive puzzle. Inevitably, there is some measure of surprise to discover that face, almost disappointment even, to find the face less attractive than expected for such a figure, or older, or younger. And in each instance, that surprise is also a bit disturbing, to realize my interest was drawn by someone so young, or so old, or that the dull face on that shapely body should prove disappointing, as if to suggest that I'm not above such crass sentiments after all. For while these observations of bodies are not exactly sexual, it is hardly an accident that those bodies and not others attract my notice. It is nearly the inverse experience on dry land, away from the water. Seeing those same swimmers in their street clothes, their hair combed, without swim caps and goggles, as if we'd all been transformed into earthlings again, but had this other existence in common, inevitably brings its own surprise, as we recognize each other uncertainly at first. But also, that unsettling separation of face and body in the water, especially when experienced from under the water, plays out in much the opposite way in our normal life. Most often, our bodies are far more covered by clothes, more concealed than any swimsuit could do, so that it is again like they are underwater or separated, nearly hidden from view in comparison to what's on top. While we perceive the general shape of the bodies around us on the street, it is the faces that draw us in. The eyes, the gaze, the mouth, the expressions and gestures, perhaps even the voice or the particular animation of that face carrying itself amid the sea of other faces. And yet, after so many years swimming in the same pool, I no longer watch the bodies as much as I used to, or not the bodies of people I know, or of swimmers I see there with some regularity. I see their bodies passing in the water, but like familiar signatures. They do not draw my curiosity in the same way as when they were completely unknown, when their mystery was most fertile. By the corresponding, if inverse, experience on dry land, do I therefore not look at familiar faces as much as when they were still unknown to me? But every face remains a mystery, even under cover of the familiar.
Okay, what's next?
All right. Okay, more than in most sports, different points in there, different words like sport here, I keep saying, oh, I don't think of swimming in that way. So, like an exercise, I don't think of it that way either. More than in most sports, another term I do not normally use for this activity, the accessories one might equip oneself with for swimming are fairly reduced, or so I like to think. Besides various accoutrements like flippers, I've even seen waterproof headphones. Why get in the water at that rate? A bathing suit and goggles are about the minimum. All I add to that are cheap flip-flops to protect my feet from the plantar warts I've occasionally gotten from the standing puddles on the way to the pool. Ah, yes, a swim cap too, as if that helps protect my hair from churning in the chlorine. Bathing suit, a basic Speedo. Now, here's a digression that I didn't know until very recently. An Australian friend told me that a recent slang term, at least in Australia, for Speedo-type bathing suits is budgie smugglers. had I known that. To which I told one fellow swimmer, and he said something about, what was it, the... something like this: the swimsuits change, but the budgie's still the same. So, bathing suit, a basic Speedo. I seem to have taken it on faith early on that a minimal suit was most befitting to a serious approach to swimming. Just keep the goods in place and carry on. In more recent years, people I know have been wearing close-fitting shorts that go almost to the knee, but so far I resist. What seemed totally not serious, though, are the boxer-type trunks, the loose sort that surfers wear. Not a chance. Too much loose material. The goggles are the real trick. In the past year, I've come to wonder if, though no mirror presents any evidence that I can see, my eyes have gradually shifted out of the normal balance. Maybe they've migrated to the same side of my nose, like in Picasso's portraits. Picasso eyes would explain why each pair of goggles start to leak barely a month after I bought them, so that they don't even make it 6 months before I've given up on them. I used to wear Speedo and other brands then of goggles. Then some years ago, I discovered an Italian brand of goggles, Aquasphere, that were really an improvement, held their seal, didn't cloud up. About every 10 or 12 months, I'd happily spring for a new pair, just over $20. But earlier this year, the last pair failed me. The lifeguard once told me I should be washing my goggles with soap instead of just water, so I was doing that. Mm-hmm. But now he pointed out that it should be in cold water because warm will stretch out the rubber. I'm such a dummy. Probably too late for that pair. But he also said they should be tightened equally on both sides, which hadn't occurred to me somehow, and of course mine were not. Still, that did not remedy things enough for my prematurely dying goggles. At last, after the summer, I went for a new brand entirely, which he had enthused about, Blue 70. They were nice, reliable, and the solarized effect, the only model available, seemed to light up the pool. But not 2 months later, in the same left eye, water was leaking through again. Did Picasso not leave an antidote behind? So this one's about time and the perception of time, basically. One of the great metaphysicians of time, Marcel Proust, wrote how some days are as though mountainous and we struggle to get through them, while others seem all downhill and we just fly along. Swimming, too, can be like that. There are days I'm convinced that my pace is slower than usual. I feel the effort more, whether because I didn't sleep as well or I've been eating too much or who knows. And yet I discover when passing other swimmers whose pace I'm familiar with or afterwards glancing at the clock that I did my mile in roughly the same 40 minutes as always. The same in clock time, perhaps, though not in my muscles and limbs, in the feeling of resistance offered by the water. But is the resistance itself ever any different? I suppose if a number of vigorous swimmers were all paddling away in there with me, it might require more effort to ply my own dogged path, or if the water temperature were markedly off from the norm. No, surely it is the feeling that varies, probably more than the external circumstances. And by the same token, there are days when I have the impression that my strokes are so robust, whether, again, from insufficient sleep, which has cast a sharp edge to my energy, or some special determination, or even suppressed anger. I must really be cutting through the water as if the wind were at my back. Nor is that the case either, I find. 40 minutes, give or take, remains indelibly my time. So, one of the fringe benefits in getting married was that my wife's one of the fringe benefits in getting married was that my wife's parents had a large pond. Out in the country, more or less still, a large round pond. Back before we had kids and when they were still small, we used to go out there more often. Much of that time, I either had not yet found a convenient pool that I liked in New York, or once I went back to graduate school, was not going to the pool often enough, and so let my gym membership expire. Therefore, whenever we took the bus out to New Jersey between May and September, I looked forward to swimming my now infrequent mile again in the pond. Even if I could swim in a straight line, the trick here was to bend it a little into a constant arc. I was not about to change my habit of alternate side breathing, but lifting my head each time and glimpsing my general coordinates, I was able to adjust my path instinctively to skirt the largest circle possible, short of running aground in the muck of the shallows. And yet I never quite understood, how does one swim in a circle? Is it a curve of the body, a way of leaning into the water, a slight emphasis in the stroke on the inward turning side of the circle? The mechanics seem like nothing almost until I start to think about it. Shouldn't swimming in a circle be more a more complicated affair than in a straight line back and forth between two points? What it comes down to, I think, may be as simple as the tension between the straight line, the swimmer's body and implicit movement, and the arc, round pond. And even removing all forward motion, figure a sleeper in a round bed, I still find a certain disconcerting incongruence. In any event, away from a swimming pool, the old questions of distance and measurement remain. Once again, I'm compelled to guess, by way of the time spent swimming, as if I had a watch with me, how many circuits, laps, around the pond it takes me to swim a mile, as if it really matters at that point. But still, one wants to establish a point of reference. So somehow, I concluded that 8 times around made a mile, approximately, which was kind of nice, of course, swimming round and round in a sizable pond. Away from that margin of the outer rim near the shallows, you couldn't see very much looking down into the water. A greenish fog, but with changing casts of light. Swimming by the outermost path, you could glance over the layered bed of leaves underwater. The pond was ringed all around by tall trees, and occasionally spot fish up to a foot long. When you lifted your face to breathe, there was the wide sky over you, way above the trees. And even so, somehow 8 times around could almost seem more monotonous than back and forth and back and forth in a pool. Strange, that. Like slow-motion sightseeing, only you're looking at different things when you're swimming around a pond. I guess it's another kind of zen in a pool, like you're on a grid so your mind is able to wander more. Dutifully, though, for some years at least, I complied with the imperative to swim in the pond when conditions merited. Round and round the pond, for a good bit longer than anyone else stayed in. My head in the water, off on my own. A pond, it seems, is a much more social setting than a pool, and yet there I was, off on my own, making up for the laps I didn't do in a pool. Long past anyone would want to wait for me. And that was nice, too, for a while, the forgotten duck paddling around, nearly forgetting himself. However, ringed by trees like that, the swimming hole was very, shall we say, biological, not to mention botanical. Among other sediments carried by the air onto the surface of the water, through much of the swimming season, there was also a fine dust of pollen that fell. In those first years circling the pond, I was fairly allergic to various sorts of weeds and things growing out in the country. So despite the tranquil paddling around, a while after I had emerged, sometimes the sneezing and itchy eyes began. From there, combined with old house mildew, the reaction just got worse through the rest of the day and night. By the next day, recovered and rested, I would plunge in again. After all, I didn't have my allergic reaction while I was actually in the water, bathed in its green coolness with no chemical additives or salt. It's all rainwater. That's a quote, which is actually what my mother-in-law would always say about the pond. That it was always clean because it's all rainwater. And from the perspective of a swimmer, I couldn't not go in just because I might be sneezing later. I had the duty, in a way, to take advantage of any body of water that would have me. Okay, all right. Right, so this is, I have one piece later in, which I won't read, but about sounds and, you know, what you hear or what you might hear. Mm-hmm. This one's about light. Light in water. Always a thrill to look under the lid of the water. Not that there is so very much to see, but that simple act, eyes behind goggles, dunking the head where it cannot naturally dwell for long, to behold anything at all underneath, is like a magic passage. So that, even before the barest of elements, one wants to see more, like a privilege that one does not easily relinquish. Even a pool in the dark would offer its own sprawling pages of light, a strange diffuse light, perhaps, but with its own drama and mystery. Certainly, every place to swim, every body of water, offers a unique set of circumstances for underwater viewing. The pool at Eastern Athletic, that's the gym where we go, 7 floors up, windows around much of 3 sides, but particularly along the southern wall, gives to the morning sunlight ready access. Sunny days, whole columns of light cast into the water from angles both direct and oblique, careening off the tiled walls below, so that the glimmering reflections hang at one end or another like a diffuse curtain, swirls of ivy, a loose handful of jewels floating before my path. From one morning to the next it will differ, with the shifts of light and cloud, the angle of the season, the folds and transparency of the water. But on overcast days, there is plenty of light still, even if untraceable to a single source. The incessant crinkling of the water's surface, as of every depth, multiplies the mere presence of light, so that from one end to the other of the pool, an endless script unfolds below. Not in any language but dazzlement, nothing to hold, no discernible shapes to reproduce, no start or finish. Like a phosphorescent algae, though without the algae, a writing with no pen that we pass through again and again to no noticeable effect. A wonder that we are not mesmerized by the play of light, that we don't swim into walls in our distraction, that we can keep to our straight lines. In ponds or the sea, by contrast, where all that dissolves settles to the muddy bottom, the light as well dissolves. Usually what we see depends on the depth of clarity, but the what is inevitably plants and fish, and, still in the shallows, the very nature of the bottom as it sinks away. But sometimes I have managed to see the light itself as it plunges below in beams or sheets or endless ribbons. Out on the open water, it may be a friendly presence, or it may blind us. It's all the same. Mm-hmm. Ah, yes. Sensory deprivation, in effect. Unplugged, disconnected, unreachable, unavailable, off the grid. Mm-hmm. The medium of water, so easy to enter, but like a door that shuts silently behind you, imperceptible. A particular kind of departure, personal and absolute in a way, solitary. When I am with my family somewhere and I go off swimming, even if they go swimming too, my wife nearby, perhaps even my daughter, while my son eagerly shares my lane or chooses to partake of a like trajectory, I am nonetheless in a realm of my own. Once I launch forth, my head immersed, all the more so in a pond or the sea, where the sides are much further apart, no one can get through to me. My departure lasts as long as I choose and cannot be interrupted by others except through great effort. There is a certain magic in this act, as well as a kind of danger, almost within reach, in plain sight, if others are looking, and yet so far from things outside, walled off by the sound of water washing in my ears, that the world could have changed immeasurably while I was away. In this regard, just as there is always the chance we might not come back any time we depart, I almost feel like I should say goodbye when I go off to swim. Will you still be there? Will I? But let's not get carried away. And this last one, I had in my set list, shall we say, one of the longer ones, but it's my mouth is already getting dry, so not test your patience. So this last one, also the way the book was written, I wrote it over, I don't know, I think it was a few months, and it's published in the order of the pieces. I wrote the pieces in the order that they're published, and at one point before it was published, the publisher asked me, I guess somebody had commented to him that questioning, or maybe it could be, you know, some other arrangement or whatever, and both he and I just sort of shrugged of, like, you know, what difference was it going to make? And I was comfortable with it, and he was comfortable with that. So So this is the last one in the book. Water isn't wet, it only makes you wet. How many times did I hear that from other kids when I was growing up? Is it true, or is it rather a smarty pants distinction? Covered or soaked with a liquid, such as water. That's the first definition of wet in my American Heritage Dictionary. So maybe those kids were right. Could water be covered or soaked with water? What is inside the water that would get soaked? Does it matter? When we speak of the qualities of water, in fact, the subject tends to escape us. After noting the obvious, that it is liquid, we only manage to speak like chemists or poets, or sometimes like physicists and engineers when considering its dynamic properties. The swimmer, of course, knows all these aspects from inside, wherever that inside is. Water is its particular qualities, in a particular place at a particular time, in a particular body of water. We might even say it is the particles themselves we are looking at in the water, which make it hard or soft, clear or murky, fresh or foul-smelling, calm or turbulent, as if the water were an essence we can only approach by way of its particular conditions. We swim in that water. We drink that water, usually not the same. As swimmers, we do have our limits, and each limit poses challenges which we might, wisely or foolishly, choose to take up. So the water is also a kind of screen or stage, a liquid screen or stage, in which we project or play out our own personal drama. Is that what swimming laps is? Not a discipline, not an exercise, not a sport, but rather rehearsals for a play that will never have its premiere? I'm not talking of you competitive folks who swim to race. Further still from water and its essential qualities as water, and even from the particles and particularities, we're inclined to see water more in terms of quantity, the size of the body, the depths and distances it contains. Water, it seems, is a medium for transport, for reverie, for nourishment, for getting wet. If on a molecular level, water retains a certain memory of what was diluted there, whether in a controlled environment, as for homeopathic ends, or in the reckless and ruinous expanses of so many ecological poisonings, it also carries a measure of our own memory, both collective and individual. So much water inside our bodies, and so we swim in bodies of water. By getting wet, we are joined to all the other bodies that came before and are with us still.